Shalom Aleichem, Chevra, Binyamin Hammer at National Council of Young Israel. We're very thrilled to have Rabbi Willig answer our calls, our shilas. I hope everyone has a copy of the shilas. Without further ado, Rabbi Willig.
Thank you very much. Full schedule today. We'll try to cover whatever we can. Question number one. Should women be encouraged or discouraged to have a mezumenet when three adult women are eating together with no men around? That's a very important question. Full disclosure, the Rosh and Brochus Perek Zion, Siman Dalet, says women are chayav to make a mezumen. Rashi and Tosfos, Mem Hey and Beis, say they may make a mezumen. I think the most relevant statement is found in the Aruch HaShulchan, Siman Kuf Tzadi Tes Siv Beis, and I quote, "For lo shamanu me'olam shenoshim yizamnu liatman." He never heard, Aruch HaShulchan knew Europe very well, never heard that women should make a mezumen for themselves. And I believe strongly that minhagim, which were firm in Klal Yisrael, I do not know of any other posik of the statue of Aruch HaShulchan who reports a different minhag, that should be maintained. If their grandmothers, by now maybe great-great-grandmothers, didn't venture the mezumen, I don't see why they should be making any changes right now. As a matter of fact, I have a suspicion that some of these changes are not coming merely from a desire to achieve a greater level of religious observance, but rather they are reflective of the changes in the outside world. As we know, there was a great degree of egalitarianism. Women have equal rights and equal opportunities, and while we are I think in favor of it with respect to the general world, equal work for equal pay for equal work, and things of this nature, but when it introduces itself into religious activity, it becomes problematic. We're all aware of the fact that in some places they introduced about 30 years ago, maybe more by now, a women's tefillah with their own Kriyas HaTorah, and then women's Megillah. After a short while, the women were reading the Megillah for the men. A little while later, women are reading the Torah for the men, all in what consider themselves nominally Orthodox institutions. I don't believe that's acceptable, and therefore this is a not unrelated to that phenomenon. Once again, I'm not questioning the motives of any particular individual or individuals in making a mezumenet, but I believe it's impossible to detach this question from the more general pattern that we see in front of our own eyes. And I must include in this context, I think it's on point, the issue of women saying Kaddish, which when I grew up was absolutely unheard of. I'm told that perhaps in Lithuania, it did exist, and Aruch HaShulchan might not have made his statement, "Lo shamana me'olam shenoshim yasu yagidu kaddish liatzman." But I'm speaking from my own experience. I grew up in different places. I never heard it until more recent years. But it became once again popular, and there's books written about it. And the streak, which is found in those books, not necessarily consistent with gender differences as found in Torahseinu HaKadosha. And if you look, as a matter of fact, in the Pischei Shuvah in Yerodea, Simon Shin Ayin Vav Sivkot and Gimel, quotes on the Chavis Yor, Shuvah's Chavis Yor, I believe it's Simon Reish Chav Beis, where he says that for a woman to say Kaddish would be Chalishas Koach HaMenhogim Shel B'nei Yisrael, would weaken the force of customs of B'nei Yisrael. And therefore, he says, Kevan Shiesh Asifo U'Pirsum, since there is a gathering and it becomes somewhat public, you have to protest. Sarach Limchos. It's interesting, that was not in a synagogue. It was in a private house. They learned and they said Kaddish. The daughter said Kaddish. Even there, since there were 10 people, the Chavetzor required a protest to stop such an activity. Now here, there's only a mezumenah, only three women. Maybe the Chavetzor would not demand any protest. But it's interesting to see the expression that he uses. The Pesach Tshuva doesn't quote the entire expression. You look in the original. As minhagim b'nei Yisrael, agam kein torahim. And if these customs are weakened, quote, v'yiyeh kol echad boneh bomo le'atzmo al pi svaroso. Everyone will make up their brand new customs, brand new ideas based on their own logic. It'll cause a terrible zilzul, a degradation of the customs that exist. And therefore, it seems to me, if someone asks you, it should be discouraged. They should be encouraged to follow the custom of their mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers. And especially since we've seen that these new customs have led to the words of the Chavetzor being fulfilled right in front of our eyes. Everyone is bona bona liatma or peace for us. All kinds of different things which we mentioned before are not in accordance with the halacha and certainly not with the spirit of halacha. That's why I believe we should discourage rather than encourage. However, those who do it, we cannot cast aspersions. It's not our role. But if the question is raised to encourage or discourage, I believe it should be discouraged. Question two and three are really the same thing. Question two. In my previous congregation, the community Rabbanim brought all their shtaros to the menahal of the Vad, who managed the sale. Now the sole Orthodox rabbi of a community recently, the local conservative rabbi, shared with me that all the rabbis, meaning my predecessor and other conservative rabbis, sell their chametz to the custodian that works at the local federation. My predecessor is out of the picture. Should I be concerned how the custodian understands the sale of chametz by these rabbis? Should I separate myself from them and find a different custodian? Or have my own private understanding with him? On one hand, he may tell the other rabbis that I am doing something different and upset them in my role in the community. On the other hand, I find a different custodian, they upset them even more, and the custodian and the federation? Question mark. Three, could I discuss the entire procedure of Mechiras Chametz? Okay. So I believe that the most important aspect that the rabbi has to see to it in arranging Mechiras Chametz is find the appropriate non-Jew to whom the chametz should be sold. I find it astounding that we are so strict when it comes to Pesach to make sure that everything is done exactly kedas u'kedin, and yet I find rabbis selling the chametz to, forgive the expression, a custodian, and often the custodian has no understanding of the business world, and after all, selling chametz is a sophisticated business sale. Some are not capable of reading the document of sale, which is often nuanced and complex, and even sometimes don't even understand English too well. I find it shocking that this practice is prevalent. To my mind, there has to be a search to find a businessman. Now, I'm not saying I have to do what was done in Omaha where they found Warren Buffett, or what a rabbi did in Washington, he found a Supreme Court justice. I'm not going that far. But a sophisticated businessman who understands what contracts mean, that's what should be found. Nothing to do with the respective custodians. Maybe some kind of custodian has this sophistication. But it's very highly unlikely. In our community in Riverdale, we found a wonderful real estate broker who understands contract law very well. And he understands what it means, the nuances of these sales and the complications involved in sales, especially if you're selling to someone in a different time zone. There are all kinds of complications. He understands what it means, a sale which is done now and takes effect later. All these nuances he understands because that's his business. So therefore, the whole idea of selling to a custodian, to me, raises questions as to how qualified the particular individual is. Again, there can always be exceptions, but generally speaking, individuals in that line of work are not as sophisticated, although there are, again, could be exceptions. I think that's the bigger concern bigger concern than the conservative and the federation is whether the non-Jew himself, what kind of level of understanding and sophistication he has. Also, he should find someone, a non-Jewish person who's wealthy, who'll be able to pay the money for the chametz, should that be the choice at the end of the day, and not to someone who was in a low socioeconomic status who would be clearly unable to do so. So for all these reasons, again, I can't speak to the particulars of the situation. I don't know what the community is like. I don't know how much of a ruckus this would cause. But if you ask me, without these considerations, I would start at ground zero, zero-based decision, find a sophisticated individual so that maybe the people in the community will not be upset that you're choosing a different individual, but rather they'll be gratified that the new rabbi in town has lifted up the level of sale to a higher degree of sophistication and of professionalism. Perhaps that'll work. But again, I can't speak to the specifics of the community. What I can speak to is the next question about the entire procedure of mechiras. Comments, obviously, you can't spend a whole hour right now on it. Just give some brief highlights. As a rule, the way it works these days, everybody appoints the rabbi as their agent to sell the chametz with a document of authorization, either their own document or they sign one document that the rabbi gives them. Ideally, this document should contain the addresses and even the rooms where the chametz is found and how much it's worth approximately. If the seller is traveling, will not be home on Pesach at all, a key should either be left with a neighbor, with the rabbi, or at the very least, a cell phone should be put on the document so that the non-Jew who needs access on Pesach will have a number to call to be able to get access somehow or other with the cooperation of the seller. Now, it's important to appoint the rabbi after you already bought all of your chametz. So if someone appointed the rabbi today and buys chametz tomorrow, it's very possible that the appointment is invalid. For this reason, it's worthwhile postponing the authorizations as long as possible. I don't mean to the last day. I mean, I don't open for business till Rosh Chodesh, and I try to the first week to stall off as much as possible, because the people who are buying chametz tomorrow for Shabbos and mowing it all up, and they'll put it away to be sold. And if they appoint to me today, it's a halachic question whether that's a valid appointment based on the Gemara Nozi Yud Beis. Iyula Mati Ovid Shtichla Mati Mashvi. It's a discussion of Mishnah Melech Chus Gerishin. Can't go into the details right now. The custom is that the rabbi gives an item of value. Old days a handkerchief, these days maybe a pen or a key or a cell phone, whatever you have in your pocket, to the congregant. And he picks that up, although the Rambam writes about this, that these things are not really halachically required and don't really make so much halachic sense in them time. But it's a minhag Yisrael to do it, and then we should try to do whatever we possibly can. If you can't, you can't. And therefore, if someone cannot come to see you in person but wants to fax or email the authorization form to you, it can be effective. The rabbi, of course, sells the chametz on Erev Pesach before the end of the fifth hour. This year, it's next Friday. In New York, it's sometime after 11:30. There's a discussion, Mogen Avram's man, a gross man, and there's different versions of Mogen Avram. So we try to get the sale done before 11:30. I think the earliest version of Mogen Avram is 11:37 or 8. And those who are flying to Eretz Yisrael, which thank God is a large percentage these days, cannot sell then. It's too late to do an early sale. It's called the Mechiras Yud Gimel. We do that sale on Erev Pesach, Erev Pesach, which is this year's Thursday, before Mincha, sometime before, let's say, 7 o'clock. And included in that sale, those who are traveling to Europe or Israel, we also include individuals who wish to avail themselves of the sale and thereby exempt themselves from Bedikas Chametz. Mishnah Berurah writes in the Matav Lamed Vav Siv Kot Lamed Beis, if such individuals is preferred, they do what we call a Mechiras Yud Gimel. So by the time all our bus rolls around, they've already sold their areas where the chometz is found, or maybe their entire home is still going away, to a non-Jewish person, which exempts them from the obligation of bidik. How do you do the sale? So there are three fundamental means of acquisition. One is money. It's a big dispute among the Rishonim. Is kesef kona for a nochri? The Gemara says, Dvar Torah mos konas liyisrael, kon miyala misecha. The nochri b'meshicha, we can't do meshicha on chometz, it's too much. But some say that you follow Rish Lakish. Rashi seems to say, and Rama says that both work. It gets out of the Gemara some interesting way, not for now. So we do kesef, and it has to be a pruta of every person. The pruta depends upon the price of silver. Right now, 2 cents would be necessary to have a pruta. 1 cent would not be enough. Silver is now, I think, about $17. Aside from the money, which is given, and we try in our sale to give the money in coins, even though, strictly speaking, dollars should really be enough, paper dollars, but we want to give it more significance, and some don't like some of the paper dollars. So the non-Jew comes with a lot of quarters, and that's what we use. But again, if necessary, you can use dollars as well. It's one pruta, which is, let's say, 2 cents, per every individual who's selling the chometz. It's a simple calculation. And aside from giving money, we do two other means of transaction. Namely, we do what's called chalipin. The non-Jew can give you a pen or some other item, which you would then pick up on behalf of those who you're representing, and that's is another means of sale. Again, controversial. With Rabbi Natama and Shach, whether chalipin, which is based on the pasuk in Megillas Rus, but the word Yisrael is mentioned, does it work for Norchem as well? And then the Situmta, a common custom of transaction, which today would be shaking hands, which again is a dispute whether it works for Norchem as well. We do all three. And we make specific reference, and so it should be said, or it certainly be written in the Shtar, that there's a severability clause. That if one of the methods works and the other two don't work, the one that works should work. And if a particular sale wouldn't work, because let's say there's a lack of sincerity on the part of the seller, the other sales are unaffected by it, that's an important provision. Step number two is to actually rent out the places where the chometz is found. Before you rent it, you should tell the non-Jew verbally that together with this rental, you're finding a fourth way to transfer the chometz, known as kinyan agav, that if you transfer real estate, you can also transfer movables together with that real estate. That should be enunciated before the actual transactions for the lease of the property. He doesn't buy our property, he leases our, rents our property, and the same three methods are used. The kesef, the chalipin, and the situmta that we use to actually buy the chometz, use it also to rent the properties. And after that's done, you enunciate yet another fifth transaction for the chometz, which is called kinyan chotzer. It seems to work based on the Gemara Masechta Avodah Zarah. And after all this is done, there should be a document, which is then signed by the rabbi and the non-Jew as well, ideally. This document is then given, together with the authorization documents, to the non-Jew. And this document itself can serve two functions. It can achieve the rental as well, because shtar does not work for metalton, but works for sfiras karka. It can also be a proof, a raya, in the hands of the non-Jew, should he deem it necessary in the future. Now, it's important that we say that the non-Jew gives a pruta now, that's 2 cents, we said before, for the chometz. The rental could be 2 cents, it's not a problem, but the chometz, it's obviously worth more than 2 cents. So the remainder will be paid when Pesach is over, give that date, the night after Pesach. The remainder will be determined by three recognized experts in New York City, wherever you happen to be, and that remainder is an outstanding debt, the non-payment of which shall in no way affect the sale or its validity. So therefore, if the non-Jew doesn't pay the money and wants to hold on to the chometz, you can take him to court, but you cannot nullify the sale. This is extremely, extremely important. I want to just end this question, because we can't spend the whole time on this one question, that some years back, I believe in 1998, the OU has a video of the sale that transpired at Riverdale between myself and the non-Jewish real estate agent, whose name happens to be Mr. John Brown. And there's even a shiur that I gave here in the yeshiva for some of the Talmidim as per their request. You can get it on their website. Okay. Question number 4 is probably the hardest question of the entire lot. This past Shabbos' tragedy has prompted many to Balabatan to ask me how we ought to understand it and what should our response be. Nistarim Darkei Hashem. Hashem's ways are mysterious. We have no idea. We cannot fathom this unspeakable tragedy of the loss of 7 innocent souls of children in their sleep. It's just, every time I even think about it, without even saying it, it shakes me all up, as it should. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible event. But at the same time, Hatzur Tom and Paulo, we have our absolute faith. I even heard on the radio on Sunday when they were interviewing people in the street. So one of them was interviewed, said that we believe in God, we have faith in God, that even if it sounds so unspeakably horrible to us, then Hashem's master plan, everything has a place. And we dare not lose our faith in Hashem, even in the face of such a terrible tragedy. Therefore, I would like to focus more on a practical response, not the theological one. And that is, be more careful. Have working smoke alarms in every home, in every room. Purchase hot plates that are safe, as safe as possible. And I'll take this opportunity to extend it. Because fire is, you know, you read in all the poskim from the Gemara and on down about the terrible fires which used to exist when all the homes were made from wood and all the lights and the heat was made from fire. In the average Jewish home, we don't deal with fire, and we have an oven, but beyond that, not, except for certain religious activities. Again, the hot plate was an exception, apparently malfunctioned. Unfortunately, there was no smoke alarm, and unfortunately, there was no safety valve, whatever. We can't go back to the past. But there are religious uses of fire, which you have to be careful about. For example, every Friday night, there's a Lucas Ner Shabbos. You have to be very, very careful. I know of many stories, one even a cousin of mine, where they lit many, many candles for many, many descendants, and it caught on fire, Hashem Yerachem, and the lady of the house was asleep. Literally, sakana safashis. Fortunately, she was awakened and no lives were lost, but the house burned down, and it was very, very, very scary. Even more dangerous is using a blowtorch before Pesach, which some people use to do kashering. I know of a case where that also cost a precious Jewish life. If you want to do it that way, hire professionals. Don't do it yourself. It's too dangerous. And let's not forget, Ner Chanukah. I'm a first-hand witness. Some years back, they had these wax, oil wax. It was a congealed oil, which is the best of both worlds. It was Shemen Zayis, and it was still congealed. It wasn't so messy. And so we bought a set of these. We thought they were in glass, and there's no problem. I happened to be sitting right opposite it. I believe Chanukah started on Thursday night. Everything was fine. Friday night, everything was fine. Maybe it started Friday night. Most of the Shabbos, everything was fine. We actually had left the house. And Sunday night, I'm sitting myself at the table, looking at the Chanukah, and all of a sudden I see, phew, the whole case burned through. It must have been made from plastic. I think it was made somewhere in the Far East. And a fire started. And it was actually a little, tiny little fire, which I quickly ran to blow out. Luckily, there was tin foil underneath the Chanukiah. Dangerous. You have to be careful to find out where these products are made and what their safety record is. I remember that when that happened, so that night later on the night, maybe saw on the email, watch out. Yeah, but we didn't see that until Sunday night. I didn't, because apparently there were some fires reported on Friday night at Motzei Shabbos from this product. So there are dangerous products out there being used for religious observances. You have to be very careful. And my final note is Bedikas Chametz. I'm aware of the Mishnah, both in the Or HaNer, in my view, Don't use a Nair. Use a flashlight only. If you use a Nair, A, it's dangerous, and B, because it's dangerous, you're likely not to do what Chazal say. Use a little Nair, not an Avuka, to get into the small areas and under the beds and into... Who's going to do that with a candle? We're afraid. We're not used to using candles. A flashlight is more important from the perspective of safety as well as from the perspective of even the Bedikas Chametz proper. Question number 5. I am fortunate to be in a growing shul with many young adults and college-age kids all home for Yom Tov. It's become most obvious that during the Yizkor service, the hallway has become quite loud. See it as a kiddush break and people do not return to Musaf or on time or at all. What do you do? Baruch Hashem, there's a young community. Why do people walk out in the first place? Why do people walk out? Look in the Shari Ephraim, Ephraim Zal Magolius, end of Lamed Beis, where he discusses two possible reasons why people walk out. One is that it's an Ayin Hara, based on Masechta Yevamos, Daf Kuf Zayin. You have a parent who's deceased, and you have parents who are alive. Why should I be suffering? He's not suffering. So Chas V'Shalom, be an Ayin Hara for those who are staying behind. All right. Another is based on the Gemara in Masechta Brachos that says that in Sugya of Takanas Ezra, that if other people are being osik in Kabbalah Samar Shemayim and I'm sitting there doing nothing, so it indicates that I am not participating. So it's not right that people should sit there and do nothing while others are reciting Yitzchak. And someone brought to my attention that apparently that reason is quoted by my Rebbe of Soloveitchik in the Marz that I was printed with his psakim. A third reason is quoted in one of the mafarshim on the bottom of the Shari Ephraim from the psicha of Levush Mordechai Baba Kama, that the people who are saying Yizkor, they're allowed to do it on Yom Tov, even though they're mentioning the departed, the lost one, the lost soul of him in the family. Because somehow gives them an oneg, it's somewhat cathartic. However, it can cause pain to those who are not saying Yizkor, and it'll be mevatel there. Simchas Yom Tov. Three reasons why those who don't say Yizkor customarily leave the shul. If it can be worked out, they should leave the shul without the negative consequences that are being described in the question. That should continue to be done. However, if for some reason it's impossible, the shul is in total disarray, and there's simply no other way out of this problem, so in theory, if 95% of the shul is not saying Yizkor and 5% is, the 5% can leave and go to a base medrash downstairs, say the Yizkor and come back. It'll be much quicker than emptying the shul from the 95%. If that for some reason is not feasible either, the rabbi can feel free if he feels it's appropriate to give a psak that everyone should stay in for Yizkor. Those who won't listen will listen. Everyone should stay in for Yizkor, but instead of doing nothing, they should be given, everyone should say a certain program of tilling. For example, let's say what they have in the Sidurim. Let's say the Shir HaMalos, there are 15 Shir HaMalos. Everyone should recite the Shir HaMalos as a Shevach V'Odoat Hashem, that they're not required to say Yizkor, that their parents are alive. And by doing so, they will not be Yoshev Batal. They'll be doing something constructive and saying Tilim, which is always appropriate. Also, there will be less of what we call an Ayin Hara, because the people who are saying Yizkor are not going to look at these people as this thing do nothing. They're also saying something. They're saying Tilim. And this final consideration would also probably not apply, because they're not going to be caused pain by a person near them saying Yizkor, because they're busy with their Tilim. That's the only idea I can come up with if they cannot do the first the two of somehow maintain the decorum in the traditional way where everyone leaving, or finding an alternate base medrash for the few percentages to go out. The best is everyone should stay and say till them while the Yizkor is being recited. Question number 6. An electrician once told me that even the American platters are crudely constructed and not intended to be on for all 25 hours of Shabbos. In the aftermath of the horrific tragedy in Flatbush this past Shabbos, which was believed to have been caused by malfunctioning plata, is it mutter for a person to set their plata to go on via a timer on Shabbos morning? I'm not sure what it means. Even the American. Maybe the questioner means that there are two types of platas. The Israeli type, we'll call it by that name, get very, very hot. And the American ones don't get so hot. I've had both types in my house. These days, most of these platas are coming, unfortunately, from the Far East, where, as we said earlier, the level of safety is not as high. It's just a reality. I think the most important thing is to buy the most safe warming tray, the most safe, and look it up in Consumer Reports. And there are, some have been approved, some are not approved, based upon their wiring and things of this nature. I have to tell you from my own experience that the quote American one that I have has never malfunctioned, doesn't get that hot, it's always fine. The quote Israeli one that I had, we had more than one, they all broke and they made noise and now it was a little bit scary. So I can see why that question is using the word even American in that context. I agree with him. I should say that nonetheless, even if you get the safest one in the world, it's still permissible to have it set on the Shabbos clock. On the contrary, unless one is worried about Rav Moshe's tshuva, Chelet Dalet Simon Samach didn't like Shabbos clocks at all, most people don't follow that tshuva. People have the air conditions on Shabbos clocks, etc. If you don't accept that stringency, it's better on the Shabbos clock. In what cases am I referring? If you put the food out on Shabbos before the clock goes on, this may be helpful in terms of the typical Hilchos Shabbos questions which exist with respect to platas. And my own personal view is that all platas, if they're non-adjustable, are permissible for solid foods, because neither of the reasons which are given for the prohibition of putting things back on fires applies. The two reasons are you may adjust the flame, which does not apply to non-adjustable, or it looks like cooking, which I do not believe applies to our platas, because we don't cook on them. So I think they're all permissible. I'm fully aware of the fact that there were those who disagree, and for a variety of reasons. Rav Yashiv is quoted in the Sefer Shvus Yitzchok on Shehiyah as disagreeing based upon a run in Shabbos that seems to maintain that even if in this particular situation the fire is not adjustable, they prohibited it because of other situations in which case the fire is adjustable. So there are those who maintain that stringency. Maybe for them, if you put the food on the plata before the Shabbos clock turns it on later on Shabbos morning, it might be permissible based upon a lengthy discussion in the Rambam and the Siman Reish and Gimel and two opinions in Chazon Ish. Can't go into right now. True, there's a second reason given for a plata, which for the Easter, which is Nirik and Mevashel. It seems to me that with respect to Nirik and Mevashel, it looks like cooking would not help. The fact that you put it on the plata before the fire goes on, because there's a din in the Mishnah Brura based on the Gemara and Beitza. One person puts the food, one person puts the fire, so they're all in violation, perhaps not as serious, but that's why it was not allowed. Although I did see just today someone emailed me a daily halacha, which claims that both Rabbi Vadya and he's quoting Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, would actually permit this even for liquid foods on the grounds that some say in Bishlach or Bishlach Balach, and they put it on before the clock goes on. I don't think that sock is normative. I don't think we accept that. Nonetheless, if it's solid, maybe it would be a little bit better from a Nirabh perspective. Perhaps, in any event, I believe that the difference would be, and we call it an American hot plate, which cannot cook, and therefore the Nirikim Avashel, that some of the Israeli poskim have spoken of. They speak about their platos, which are very hot, being used either by Sfardim, they say they have an accustomed to cook on them, someone went somewhere in the army they cook on them, someone said they put kugels on them on Friday or they aren't fully cooked before Shabbos. I've read all these, heard all these possibilities. I don't think they apply to the American style. I've never seen people use any kind of hot plate to cook in this country. But in any event, if it's what we call the American Kamish cannot cook, then it'd be more of a reason to be lenient if you're putting the pot on the fire before the Shabbos clock goes on. Rav Moshe's opinion in hot plates in general is a subject of controversy itself. Some claim, according to Rav Moshe, there's no problem of non-adjustable hot plates at all. That's not my read. That's not what Rav Moshe's son told me. So therefore, there are those who are more strict for hot plates, and therefore the Shabbos clock might be even beneficial halachically and not detrimental. This, I believe, is something which should be considered very, very strongly. In my own house, we've had Shabbos, these pot plates on Shabbos clocks for a long time. I believe it's something which should be considered. And again, if the type of plata is not hot enough to cook the particular food that you're putting on it, chicken or kugel, etc., even if it's hot enough to which we call out to lettuce boat to make water, there's a ran, another ran in Masechta Shabbos, which seems to indicate that there would be no nirik mevashel, wouldn't look like cooking in that kind of a case, which is very helpful, again, especially for the American type, which are not as hot. And although the Bialach and Reishnim Gimel says that the Mechaba doesn't accept that ran, my belief is that the Ramah in Dake Moshe and later in the Haggah, in fact, does accept that ran, and therefore that is an additional consideration. Okay, 7. Should one be makpid to daven ma'ariv after tzeis on the Lel HaSeder, or one can one daven earlier so long as he begins to Seder after tzeis? There's no need to wait till tzeis for tefillas ma'ariv. The only need is for Kizman Krishma. That's a general need that applies every single day. And so there are many shuls that typically on Friday night, they'll daven after the earliest version of tzeis, let's say half an hour after the sun sets beneath the horizon, some even more than 20 minutes. And they can do that on Leil HaSeder as well, even though they would not call it tzeis for other purposes. But if for some reason even that's too late and they want to daven ma'ariv immediately after Shkia on Friday night this week, which next week, which is Seder, I think it's okay. Everyone should be reminded to say Kriya Shema again. Will people then be nichshal and starting to say it before Tzeis HaKachavim? I don't think so, because Marav takes a few minutes, especially if it's shul that say halal, takes even longer. And by the time they get home and get started and get rolling, it'll be after Tzeis of almost according to all the opinions that we normally go by. It's only the Rabbanan, the Kiddush part. So therefore, if it's necessary, permissible on Friday night. On Motzei Shabbos, in most shuls, we don't daven in Motzei Shabbos into Yontif or Motzei Yontif Rishon until later Zman to prevent people from doing things earlier than they should be doing so. But again, a Rav has the right to move it up earlier than he would a typical Motzei Shabbos or Yontif in order to help people get home earlier. Although once again, and Motzei Shabbos, you can't start to say that early because of the preparations that have to be done after the Zman. So a rabbi should use his judgment. Question number 8. Can a person kasher their glass stovetop? If yes, how? And when the glass stovetops first came out, they were possible to be actually, you could purchase an additional one, which you use for Pesach. One of my Talmidim did it. And he's able to unscrew the year-round one and put in the Pesach one every single year. I'm told the newer ones don't have that ability. So therefore, if someone will actually pour boiling water on the glass top, whether it works or not, it's a matter of discussion, especially Ashkenazim, not so keen on kashering glass, but some say you can. Some say you don't even need kashering. That's more of a Sephardic custom, and I'm not sure what the glass is made of exactly. My problem with pouring the water is I think it may ruin the electronics underneath the glass top. I don't want to ruin anyone's oven. There were those who put the oven on, the glass top oven to the highest setting, leave it on for half an hour. There's a concept of kabolo kachpolto, where that applies to to Libun is a serious halachic discussion. Some say yes, some say no. I believe that the custom in Europe, as Rav Henkin reports it, quoted in the Sefer HaGolas Kalim, and as others would have it, is that while we might not rely on Kabbalah Kapoto if this surface actually touches the food, in cases of an oven or a stovetop where the paste is thicker, food is not going to touch the surface of the oven, there's room to rely upon this idea of putting up to the highest as a sufficient kashering method. Even in the worst case, that there'll be a spill on there was a spill of chametz before Pesach, and there's a spill of chametz of Pesach bigger food as well, and there's a little bit of liquid between the pot and the glass top. According to the Chavos Das, we can still apply the principle of Ein Belua Yotzi Mikli Likli Bula Rotev. This is actually a real puddle, which is unlikely. It's true the Yadi Yehuda disagrees, but the Chavos Das opinion can be relied upon in this kind of a situation. But special care should be taken. There should be no leaks over Pesach. That would be very, very important. Ideally, if you can purchase a little kind of a trivet or some kind of a little small item that the pot can be elevated, even the smallest amount, over above the glass top, I believe would still get hot enough to do the cooking. And yet, the problems will be solved if it's lifted up a little bit above the glass top, if that can be done logistically. So everyone has to calculate that for themselves. Question number 9. An elderly couple are making Pesach at home after many years. When they went through their silverware, they did not remember which pattern is there, which is Sleshik. The children live in Israel, do not know. One of the children told me they're not sure if any of the silverware even titled. What should we do? It's a very simple situation. One of the children should go into the house, kasher the silverware with Haggalah, which is not so difficult, and put them in the mikvah to solve the tefillah problem. That would be a mitzvah of kibud avim. Question 10. I am in a blend type shul of Alabatim and B'nai Shiva where the prayers for U.S., Eretz Yisrael, Medina, and Tzal have always been said. Talking during these fields is quite significant and has become a noticeable chil Hashem. In order to achieve decorum, I start asking people to rise for the national Mishaberachs. Something or not something indicating that these Mishaberachs are relevant to us all and should be given proper respect. I felt that based on Mispal, Bishloma, Shomalchos, and even, quote, even if you don't have to serve in the IDF, we certainly are all responsible to daven for the soldiers, end quote, that I was well within a responsible balance to ask people to rise as to achieve decorum. The strategy to achieve decorum has worked wonders, and B'li Ayin Hara, the shul is almost a perfect decorum. But I got a bit of pushback from some raised in the yeshiva as to how could I possibly accord such honor to these prayers. One respected yeshiva person will make sure to sit down, one will someone orderly recite Tehillim, and another one only objected privately. Can I share thoughts on this topic? Every place has its own minhagim. Every single shul has its own customs. Some say these things, some don't say these things. And it's hard for me to tell a shul what to do. I think it should just keep the old minhag from before, whatever that was. Apparently in this shul, it's always been said. I get the impression that all three, the U.S., the Medina, and Sal, have always been said. And apparently evoked no protest on anybody's part. I believe the individual who came to you privately, which is the correct way to do it, deserves an answer. I think the answer is, Mr. Rabbi, if you didn't protest when it was being said, when people were sitting down with a chil Hashem of lack of decorum, why are you suddenly protesting now when people are standing up and there's no chil Hashem? That doesn't make too much sense to me. I mean, that's a logical argument which could be used to a logical person who has the courtesy to make his protest in private, in conversation with the Rav. He deserves that answer. If he has a better answer, if he can, good answer for that question, call me up and I'll respond. Now, those who protest publicly, that's not nice. But to speak to them directly may not work. Perhaps, and I don't know the case over here, one could speak to their quote-unquote Rosh Yeshiva. If they're a Yeshiva person, they should have a Rosh Yeshiva to speak to and tell them that no one has ever protested in all the years that it was being said quietly, was said sitting down, notwithstanding the ruckus that took place in shul, and now you want to avoid chil Hashem and standing up. You don't think it's so appropriate for these individuals to make it be a public protest. You think everyone should stand up, And if you don't believe in standing up, you know, they stand up now for the Aseres Hadibros. The Rambam says you can't do it. In my opinion, even if Rambam is right, if in your shul they stand up, you should stand up. You don't sit down when everyone else is standing up. I don't think it's the right thing to do, necessarily. Saying Tillim audibly, say, cite me to Tillim. No one's going to stop you from doing that. It's just not right to do these things. I think it's inappropriate, even if you believe that these Mishaberach shouldn't be said. All right? No one's asking you to say it. Just stand there quietly, and if you want to have some kind of internal protest, just look at your sitter and cite me to Tillim. But don't sit down and don't say the Tillim orders. It's not right. If you can approach these people directly and they'll respond to you properly, that's fine. Maybe you can, again, as I said, talk to the Rosh Hashiva to try to achieve that goal. Question 11. Is there any type of sroah which is inappropriate for a ger to have? Often gerim, when converted as children, grow up to excel in yeshiva and connect the rabbonis and dayonis. Is there any restriction that with a ger issuing rulings of discretion, such as a kinas in a communal setting, deciding the amount for child support, or deciding at what point the hashkacha should be pulled from an eatery for a violation to make a point? Moshe is a tshuva about this. He's actually talking about a woman. Can she be a mashkicha for kashrus? Or Moshe says no. That would presumably apply to a ger as well. The assumption of a Moshe, I think, in that is that there is a communal theme to this idea, which is srara. In the case of the Gemara, Moshe quotes, if someone is appointed by the mayor of the town to be responsible for the water measures, who gets how much water, and a ger is not qualified to serve in that capacity. It's a communal position. Somewhat hard for me to understand, Rav Moshe has a tshuva in a later volume where he seems to say that a ger can serve as a Rosh Hashiva. He compares it somehow to a person who owns a factory. A ger can certainly own a factory, and then he can hire and fire as he pleases. This comparison is not understood by myself. I don't understand it. That's a private situation. It's true. If I have a private shul, a shtibul, it belongs to me, the house belongs to me, it's all mine, then if the person's a ger, he can run that shul too. It's a private minion. But once you talk about a communal position where there's a sense of a communal responsibility, and there are officers, and there's a bylaws, and you know, like as shuls work with certain responsibilities, it seems to me that assuming that the rabbanus is a sroah, which I think it is, that a ger should not be serving in that capacity. So it appears to me, and certainly not as a dayan. You know, it's things such as child support. That's real dayanus. I'm not sure what it means, a kinos in a communal setting. I'm not sure what the question really means. Obviously, he's allowed to speak and say, if he's a good speaker, there's no problem whatsoever. But to be a dayan, I don't believe it's appropriate. Now, there were those who claimed to me that today a dayan is only by mutual consent only. It's not in the old days where the dayan can impose himself on others. I'm not impressed by that argument because there was a certain measure of what we call today kfiya, of compulsion. Not that a bezin can impose itself on other people, but we call the hazmana process where one rabbi, one party summons the other to a bezin, and the other one sort of has to go, not to be misarif. So there is a kind of a kfiya, and therefore I don't think that a ger should serve as such a bezin either. There may be certain ways out of that. My rabbi had a way out that the ger can serve as the halakhic decisor, as Shmaya Avtalion did. My rabbi said in the famous shir that they served as the decisors. They were the most qualified. But the formal rulings were given by others. Yet, there are others who say that if no one is qualified as a ger or as a woman in that case, that he or she can serve in these capacities. That, of course, requires a very careful evaluation of the facts in each specific case. Question 12. Unpacking their paste of China, a couple found a few plates that had broken and were seeking to replace them to complete their set. Found a company online that used pieces of their pattern for sale. It's assumed that a hot tray was eaten on it. Company says they have been stocked for at least 5 to 7 years. Pattern has been for 9 years. Not expensive china. Porcelain is meaningful to them. Can you purchase and kosher and use it? Answer is no. No, we don't kosher china. We just don't do it. The short answer is no. Question 13. As chaplain in a non-for-profit or even for the profit world. A, what defines a Jewish institution with respect to ownership / sale of a chametz? Is it a majority of trustees? The other, for example, does the hospital need to sell its chametz? B, can a concerned employee or even a patient act on their behalf in this regard without knowledge of senior management, assuming it's too late to secure appropriate shalichus, or they would object, they wouldn't agree? C, is any problem make a sale which may not reciprocally be required? The only easy answer here is C, no problem. B is problematic. You should go as high up as you can in the totem pole of administration to get their consent for this sale. If you can't go too high, you should go to the president, chairman of the board, or some chairman of the area of patient services, as high up as you can get to authorize this sale. Is it actually needed? How do you define Jewish? That's a very complex question, very hard to answer. Now I'm almost out of time. There are differences in administration. Some of you know that in our yeshiva, there's a whole discussion now with Einstein and Montefiore. While they're both, technically speaking, have Jewish roots, I think Einstein is more Jewish than Montefiore is. Einstein is a kosher hospital, and Montefiore, to this point, has not been. Nonetheless, there are all, I mean, Mount Sinai is also, in some sense, Jewish. Its official name is Bikur Cholah, for those who know, go back in time. There are complications as to who actually controls these hospitals. Now, they're being, as you know, there's mergers and acquisitions. It's a whole complex system these days, and it's hard to know for sure who owns them. I say a chaplain should sell the chametz if it won't work, so it won't hurt. We said before, there's severability, but an attempt should be made to make that sale. Now, our final question is question number 14. I'll try to answer as quickly as possible. What types of chametz must one remove during the Vidigas chametz? Of course, because of Isur B'Mashu, eating areas such as kitchen tables, and probably even kitchen floors, need to be rid of even small crumbs. However, from a strict halakhic perspective, as well as practical perspective, not eating areas such as bedroom floors, what is the shear? If it's the kazayit, would we use the literal size of an olive that we find in modern times, such as a goya olive jar? Would we use whatever shear we tend to use in general for bracha achronos, such as chazan ishir of chayim na? Is a complete chametz food item, such as Ritz cracker, considered to be an item of chashivut that would require removal, even if it's smaller than a kazayit? Here's the answer. You're right. Kitchen tables, everything should go off. Floors, not necessary. Even kitchen floors, not necessary. The shear is a kazayit, yes. It's a kazayit, even if it's a kazayit can be accumulated from the entire room, maybe even from an entire vacuum cleaner, that's a problem. What's the shear kazayit? Yes. An olive in the goya olive jar. That is a real kazayis. We may have chumris for chazanish, but that's not lakula. And therefore, a Ritz cracker is certainly more than a kazayis, I believe, of an olive in the goya jar. And so it would require removal for sure. Two, what is the mechanism by which a congregant includes or excludes items or areas from his or her sale of chametz? For example, a congregant who is going away for Pesach may want to exclude a small room from the sale in order to obligate himself in b'digas chametz in that room. And all congregants need to exclude those items that are being destroyed by fire, dietary consumption before this man, garbage disposal, or other means. It would seem preposterous that we would be burning chametz that has already been included in the sale to the non-Jew. How do we exclude it? This is necessary for the congregants to tell the presiding rabbi that they plan to exclude certain rooms or items with the congregant having them in mind. That makna enough. That's an excellent question. Ideally, the sale of chametz should take place after everything has been gotten rid of, everything, with the possible exception of the 10 crumbs that we burn in the fire, which in fact should better be done after the sale. And when I do the mechira with the non-Jew on Erev Pesach, I take a bag of the 10 crumbs with me. It's in my hand. I say, Mr. Brown, these 10 crumbs and their equivalent for all the other people I'm selling for are not going to be sold to you for the precise reason. We want to burn them in the fire. We don't want to burn your chametz. And he understands that that's an exception to the rule. Everything else should be gotten rid of before the sale takes place. Not necessarily before the appointment of the rabbi takes place, but before the sale takes place. Therefore, it is indeed preposterous for burning chametz which has been included in the sales of the non-Jew. You're right. The way to do it is to only burn a little amount, not to burn a lot, that has been specifically excluded from the sale to the non-Jew. Now, you want to do bedikas chametz on a room, there's no problem. You may not include the whole room in the sale, but you certainly are including the chametz in the room in that sale. If you somehow fail to get rid of it, it's included in the sale, but you're not burning it. So therefore, there's no problem. What you're eating before the zman is also not included in the sale, because by the time it's sold, it's after the sofas man achila. It's already gone. Garbage disposal, I mean, you made it hefker, it's no longer yours, and therefore presumably it's not included in the sale either. So therefore, the only real problem is the 10 crumbs, and that should be specified when we're speaking to the non-Jew on Erev Pesach. 3, suppose an individual does a halakhically insufficient job in bedikas chametz, or does not perform bedikah at all. Does mechiras chametz exempt them from the chiyu to perform bedikah after the mechira has already been performed? The answer is no. But even though they sold all their chametz, nonetheless, we're not supposed to be walking around houses which have chametz around, certainly as far as the kazayas, even if it belongs to a non-Jew, technically speaking. So therefore, the bedikas chametz must be done. Question 4. In practical terms, what are the required shirim of matzah, machine or hand, and morar, and even charosa to be in the Seder? It's necessary to eat 2 kazesim, one for motzi, one for matzah, or for both motzi and matzah, both afikoman. To make a long story very short, I refer you to an article I wrote in something called Pesach to Go. I believe it was in 2011. You can get it online as well. Strictly speaking, the size of a real olive, a goya olive, is very, very small. It's about approximately 1/20th the size of a hand matzah, very small amount. We are trying to be strict because the Mechaber says in Hilchos Pesach, I believe Tav Pei Vav, to eat the size of a half an egg. An egg without the shell is 22 and a half cc's, so you should have 11 and a quarter cc's. That's the sheet that's found over there. As you know, a fluid ounce is close to 30 cc's, so it's a small amount, and there's a table there which tells you what percentage of a hand matzah. Most of you use hand matzahs, you have to use a paste depending on how thick the hand matzah is. And the average hand matzah, so you have 1/5 of that hand matzah, that is enough to be the kazayas of the 11 and a quarter cc's or grams. I take it back. It's 22 and a half cc's, which is 11 and a half and a quarter grams, because the matzah is, we're not going into the details. You'll look up that article, you'll see. So that's what you'd have, 1/5. Ideally, a person is supposed to have 2 kazesim, and ideally, a person is supposed to double the shear of the kabesa, as the Chazanish did. Those are not, how should we say, to be combined. We don't include the chiyuv of the Chazanish to double the shear for the din derabbanan of the 2 kazesim. So therefore, ideally, if your stomach can handle it, should be eating 2/5 of a hand matzah. My Rebbe, Zichron of the Bracha, would say that the Tziv has it in his parish in the Shultas, based on the Rambam, that the more matzah you eat on Seder night, the greater mitzvah you have. So therefore, it would not be something which is wasted, even if you're having more than the shear. Afikoman, again, depends how you feel about it at that point in time. If you're still up to it, having 2/5 of a matzah would be okay. If you don't, 1/5 is okay. And if you really don't, you can go by the shear kazayas of the real olive and the goya olive jar, which is a much smaller amount. 5. Some sfarim and yemenites produce soft matzah, which is similar to pita bread. This would seem to have the advantage over our familiar hard matzah, and that it may be more digestible, tastier, and edible, and thicker as well. Maybe easier to eat a correct shear. What is the correct shear of eating for this amount of matzah? It's the same amount. I obviously have to have a different calculation based on how soft it is, but the same number of cc's. I've heard different opinions regarding whether the matzah is on Ashkenazim. It seems to me that technically speaking, of course, it's permissible because we assume that it's under a proper supervision. But minig Ashkenazim for hundreds of years has been to only teach the hard matzahs, and I think we should stick with Amenhag. It goes back to my first question. 6 and final. After Pesach, is it permitted to purchase items which may not be chametz gomer, such as ketchup made with vinegar, being that we don't know what the source of the vinegar was, from a Jewish-owned store that did not sell us chametz? This is a suffix on an Issur de Rabbanan. Again, it all depends upon the circumstances. We try our best to avoid Chol Moed Shavuot Pesach. If there's a need, a specific pressing need to rely on a suffix, we're able to do so. I'm sorry if I went a little bit over. I wish everybody a Chag Kosher V'Sameach, and a Mitzvah after Pesach, we can resume. Rabbi Ham, are you there?
Rebbe, I'm sorry. I want to thank Rebbe for being on the phone. A few emails came in. Three particular Rabbanim are asking me if I can get a copy of Rebbe's Shtar Mechira to send out to them. Would that be possible?
What I will do is I'll get you an email of the Shtar Mechira. You can send it to everybody.
Terrific. Whatever you want. And the last one, Rav asked, is it proper to use an English language contract enforceable in New York courts rather than the traditional Shtar?
No, I only use the English language. So I'll have it emailed. You'll give me your email later, and we'll take care of it.
Thank you, Rebbe. Take care.
Okay.
Have a chag kosher. We hope to call on you after Yom Tov. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.